This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Truman by David McCullough, narrated by Nelson Runger.
Part 1. Son of the Middle Border. Chapter 1. Blue River Country. As an agricultural region, Missouri is not surpassed by any state in the Union. It is indeed the farmer's kingdom. The History of Jackson County, Missouri, 1881. Section 1. In the spring of 1841, when John Tyler was president, a Kentucky farmer named Solomon Young and his red-haired wife, Harriet Louisa Young, packed their belongings and, with two small children, started for the far west. They had decided to stake their future on new land in the unseen, unfamiliar reaches of westernmost Missouri, which was then the extreme frontier of the United States. They were part of a large migration out of Kentucky that had begun nearly 20 years before. Inspired by accounts of a new Eden in farthest Missouri, by reports sent back by Daniel Morgan Boone, the son of Daniel Boone, and by the fact that in 1821 Missouri had come into the Union as a slave state. The earliest settlers included families named Boggs, Daly, and Adair, McCoy, McClelland, Childs, Pitcher, and Gregg. And by 1827 they had founded a courthouse town called Independence, pleasantly situated on high ground in Jackson County, in what was often spoken of as the Blue River Country. Those who came afterward, at the time of Solomon and Harriet Louisa Young, were named Hickman, Holmes, and Ford, Davenport, McPherson, Mann, Noland, and Nolan, Freeman, Truman, Peacock, Shank, Wallace, and Whitsett, and they numbered in the hundreds. Nearly all were farmers, plain-mannered and plain-spoken, people with little formal education. Many of them were unlettered, even illiterate. They were not, however, poor or downtrodden as sometimes pictured. Only by the material standards of later times could they be considered wanting. And though none of them were wealthy, some, like red-haired Harriet Louisa, came from families of substantial means. She had said goodbye to a spacious Greek Revival house with wallpaper and milled woodwork, the Kentucky home of her elder brother and guardian, William Gregg, who owned numerous slaves and landholdings running to many hundreds of acres. The great majority of these people were of Scotch-Irish descent. They were Baptists, and they were Democrats. And like Thomas Jefferson, they believed that those who labored in the earth were the chosen people of God. They saw themselves as the true Americans. Their idol was Andrew Jackson, Old Hickory of Tennessee, one man with courage makes a majority Jackson, the first president from west of the Alleghenies, who was of their own Scotch-Irish stock. It was for him that Jackson County had been named, and like him, they could be tough, courageous, blunt, touchy, narrow-minded, intolerant, and quarrelsome, and obstinate. Lord, grant that I may always be right, for thou knowest I am hard to turn, was a line from an old Scotch-Irish prayer. With their Bibles, farm tools, and rifles, their potent corn whiskey, their black slaves, they brought from Kentucky a hide-bound loathing for taxes, Roman Catholics, and Eastern ways. Their trust was in the Lord and common sense. That they and their forebears had survived at all in backwoods Kentucky, or earlier in upland Virginia and the Carolinas, was due primarily to good hard sense, as they said, and no end of hard work. They were workers, and they were loners, fiercely independent, fiercely loyal to their kind. And they were proudly prolific. David Daly, recorded as the first man to break the prairie sod in Jackson County, came west with a wife and 12 sons. While Christopher Mann, who outlived everybody of that generation, had already produced with his Betsy 17 sons and daughters, and with a second marriage fathered 8 more. Years afterward, at age 87, this memorable Jackson County pioneer could claim he had never lost a tooth from decay and could still hold his breath for a minute and a half. They believed in big families. They came from big families. Children were wealth for a farmer, as for a nation. President Tyler himself had 8 children, and in another few years, at age 54, following the death of his first wife, he would remarry and have 7 more children, making a total of 15, a presidential record. Solomon Young, who was one of 11 children, and his wife, Harriet Louisa, one of 13, were from Shelby County, Kentucky, east of Louisville. And so was Nancy Tyler Holmes, a widow with 10 children, who made the journey west to Missouri 3 or 4 years later, about 1845, once her sons had established themselves in Jackson County. Carrying a sack of tea cakes and her late husband's beaver hat in a large leather hat box, she traveled in the company of several slaves and her 2 youngest daughters, one of whom, Mary Jane Holmes, was secretly pining for a young man back in Shelby County named Anderson Truman. He was one of 12 children. If Solomon and Harriet Louisa Young were acquainted with any of the Holmes or Truman families by this time, there is no record of it. Nearly everyone made the expedition the same way, traveling the wilderness not by wagon or horseback, but by steamboat. The route was down the winding Ohio River from Louisville, past Henderson and Paducah, to the confluence of the Mississippi at Cairo, then up the Mississippi to St. Louis. Changing boats at St. Louis, they headed west on the Missouri, the Big Muddy, fighting the current for 457 miles, as far as the river's sudden dramatic bend. There they went ashore, at either of 2 miserable, mud-bound little river settlements, Wayne City or Westport, which put them within a few miles of Independence, still the only town of consequence on the frontier. With the terrible current against them, the trip on the Missouri took a week. The shallow-draft boats were loaded so deep the water broke over the gunwales. Wagons and freight jammed the deck, cordwood for the engines, mules, horses, piles of saddles and harness, leaving passengers little room. One side-wheel steamer of the era that sank in the river and was only recovered more than a century later carried cargo that included everything from axe handles and rifles to school slates, doorknobs, whale oil lanterns, beeswax candles, 2,500 boots and shoes, and thousands of bright-colored beads and buttons intended for the Indian trade. Day after day, the heavy, shadowed forest passed slowly by, broken only now and then by an open meadow or tiny settlement where a few lone figures stood waving from among the tree stumps. Some trees towering over the river banks measured 6 feet through. On summer mornings, the early filtered light on the water could be magical. These were the years of the great Missouri River paintings by George Caleb Bingham. The river Bingham portrayed was the settler's path. The distant steamer appearing through the sun-filled morning haze in his Boatman on the Missouri, as an example, could be the Radnor, the Henry Bry or Winona, any of 20-odd river packets that carried the Kentucky people. The only notable sign of civilization west of St. Louis was the state capitol on a bluff at Jefferson City, a white limestone affair, very substantial in execution, within which was displayed a full-length portrait of Senator Thomas Hart Benton, Missouri's own thundering voice of westward expansion. The painting was said to have cost the unheard-of sum of $1,000. Besides those from Kentucky, the migration included families from Virginia, the Carolinas, and Tennessee, who, with the Kentuckians, made it a predominantly Southern movement, and so one of numerous slaveholders other than Nancy Tyler Holmes. Possibly Solomon Young, too, brought slaves. In later years, it is known, he owned three or four, a cook, a nursemaid, one or two farmhands, which was about the usual number for those bound for Jackson County. They were farmers, not cotton planters, and for many, a slave was a mark of prosperity and social station. Still, the accumulative number of black men, women, and children traveling to the frontier was substantial. Incredibly, one Jabez Smith, a Virginia slave trader who set up business near Independence, is on record as having transported more than 200 slaves. White, black, young, and old, they crowded the upbound steamers in the company of hellfire preachers and card sharps, or an occasional pallid Easterner traveling west for his health. Old journals speak, too, of uniformed soldiers on their way to Fort Leavenworth, blanketed Kaw or Kansas Indians, French fur traders and mountain men with their long hair and conspicuous buckskins, a seemingly endless, infinitely colorful variety of humankind and costume. Nancy Tyler Holmes is said to have worn a white lace cap that concealed an ugly scar. As a child in Kentucky, during a Shawnee uprising, she allegedly saved herself by pretending to be dead, never moving or making a sound as she was being scalped. True or not, the story served long among her descendants as a measure of family grit. The feeling, in surviving accounts, is of noisy, good company and wild scenery, and of history as an immediate and entirely human experience. Lieutenant John Charles Fremont, the celebrated Pathfinder, came up the river in 1842 on his first exploring expedition to the Rockies. One traveler described Fremont's party as healthy and full of fun and elasticity, by no means a choir of psalm singers nor Quakers. They ate, drank, talked, sang, played cards, and smoked cigars when they pleased and as much as they pleased. The following year, 1843, came John James Audubon. In the summer of 1846, a young historian from Boston, Francis Parkman, stood at the rail of the Radnor, marveling at the immense brown sweep of the river, its treacherous snags and shifting sandbars. "The Missouri is constantly changing its course," Parkman was to write in The California and Oregon Trail, his classic account of the journey, "wearing away its banks on one side while it forms new ones on the other. Its channel is continually shifting. Islands are formed and then washed away. And while the old forests on one side are undermined and swept off, a young growth springs up from the new soil upon the other. It was frightful," he noted, "to see the dead and broken trees thick-set as a military abatis, firmly embedded in the sand and all pointing downstream, ready to impale any unhappy steamboat that at high water should pass over them." The landing near Independence was described approvingly as a wild and enterprising region. It was also in that summer of 1846 that Anderson Truman came on from Kentucky, and for some unexplained reason on horseback, which was one of the few exceptional things ever recorded about Anderson Truman. Possibly he couldn't afford boat passage. Of this first Truman to reach Jackson County, there was not a great deal to be said. His full name was Anderson Shipp, S-H-I-P-P, or Shipp, S-H-I-P-P-E, Truman. His people were English and Scotch-Irish, and farmers as far back as anyone knew. His father, William Truman, had come into Kentucky from Virginia about 1800, and reportedly served in the War of 1812. Andy, as he was called, grew up on the Truman Farm near the tiny crossroads village of Christiansburg, Kentucky. He was slight, gentle, soft-spoken, 30 years old, and without prospects. Nonetheless, Mary Jane Holmes, who was 5 years younger, had seen enough in him to defy her mother and marry him. On the pretext of visiting a married sister, she had returned to Kentucky earlier that summer and once there announced her intentions. Her mother, the redoubtable Nancy Tyler Holmes, was horrified, as she let Mary Jane know in a letter from Missouri dated July 24, 1846, a letter dictated to another of her daughters, which suggests that Nancy Tyler Holmes may have been illiterate. Since hearing the news, she had been unable to sleep or eat. "Mary, are you the first daughter I have that has refused to take my advice?" What made Anderson Truman so unacceptable is unclear. An explanation given later was that Mother Holmes thought Mary Jane was marrying down, since the Trumans had no slaves. The wedding took place in Kentucky in mid-August at the home of the married sister, a handsome red brick house with white trim that still stands. Then Mary Jane's Mr. Truman, as she would always refer to him, set off by horse for the wild country of Missouri, intending to stay only long enough to secure the blessing of his new mother-in-law. His first letter from Missouri reached Mary Jane a month later. To his amazement, he had been welcomed with open arms, her mother and sisters all hugging and kissing him, everybody laughing and crying at once. He was urged to stay and take up the frontier life. He could be happy anywhere, even in Missouri, he wrote to Mary Jane, if only she were with him. "As for myself, I believe that I would be satisfied if you was out here. I believe I can live here if you are willing." She arrived by steamboat, and with her mother's blessing and the wedding gift of a home slave named Hannah and her child, the young couple settled on a rented farm belonging to a prominent local figure, Johnston Likens, a Baptist missionary, preacher, and physician, who had come to the frontier originally to bring salvation to the Indians, but had lately turned to land speculation. He and others were in the throes of founding a new town on the Missouri's Great Bend, at the juncture of the Kansas River and the Missouri, this to be ambitiously named Kansas City. To such men, the future was in towns and trade. They talked of geographic advantages plain to anyone who looked at a map. Here was the Missouri, the great natural highway downstream to St. Louis, and so to New Orleans, Louisville, or Pittsburgh. There, upstream, beyond the Great Bend, stretched all the Northwest and its immeasurable opportunities. Here also, importantly, began the overland trails to Santa Fe, California, and Oregon. Jackson County was the threshold, the jumping-off point, to an entire second America of dry grasslands reaching clear to the Rockies. In a newly published guidebook to the Santa Fe Trail called Commerce of the Prairies, 1844, the author, Josiah Gregg of Jackson County, portrayed Independence as the port of embarkation for the Grand Prairie Ocean. In fact, Independence, Queen City of the Trails, was the country's first western boomtown. And to newly arrived settlers after long days on the river, it seemed a metropolis of stores, blacksmith sheds, wagon shops, of crowded streets and unceasing commotion. The crack of bullwhips split the air like rifle fire as wagon trains made up for Oregon. Mexican caravans from Santa Fe rolled in with still more wagons, pack mules, and hundreds of thousands of dollars in Mexican gold to be spent on American trade goods. The spring Solomon Young and his family arrived, one Santa Fe caravan of 22 wagons, is reported to have brought $200,000 in gold specie. Like a seaport town, Independence had a customs house. "Mules, horses, and wagons at every corner," observed Francis Parkman. "Groups of hardy-looking men about the stores, and Santa Fe emigrant wagons standing in the fields around. Some of these ox wagons contained large families of children peeping under the covering." The permanent population of Independence by the 1840s was perhaps only 700 people. But on any spring day, 2,000 or 3,000 would be congregated in or about Jackson Square, at the center of which stood a trim red-brick courthouse with a fanlight over the door. Of the several public houses around the square, the largest and best known, the two-story brick Noland House, was acclaimed the westernmost hotel in America, offering accommodations for 400 guests, provided no one minded sleeping 2 or 3 to a bed. The nearby wagon shops were the shipyards of the Prairie Ocean, and no wagons supposedly were better suited for the rigors of a prairie crossing than those built by a free black man named Hiram Young, an enterprising manufacturer who, like nearly everyone involved with the feeding, housing, or outfitting of emigrants, was prospering handsomely. But it was land that the Kentucky people came for. The high, rolling, fertile, open country of Jackson County, with its clear springs and two considerable rivers, the Little Blue and the Blue, both flowing out of Kansas Territory. Every essential was at hand. Limestone quarries, splendid bluegrass pastures very like those of Kentucky, and ample timber where the creeks and rivers ran. "To live in a region devoid of the familiar sight of timber seemed unendurable," reads one old chronicle, "and the average Kentuckian could not entertain the idea of founding a home away from the familiar forest trees." They counted hickory, ash, elm, sycamore, willow, poplar, cottonwood, and oak in 3 or 4 varieties. Walnut, the most prized, was the most abundant. Entire barns and houses were to be built of walnut. It was land beautiful to see, rising and falling in broad swells and giving way to long horizons. Prairie grass was high and green. Wild flowers, wild herbs, meadow rose, turtlehead, snake root, wolfberry, thimbleweed, grew in fragrant profusion everywhere the prairie remained unbroken. And starting about 10 miles south of Independence, the country was nearly all still prairie. To cut through the sod with a plow took 6 to 8 yoke of oxen. Horses wouldn't do. But beneath the crust, the dark prairie loam could be 2 to 6 feet deep. In places along the river bottoms, it was 20 feet deep. Josiah Gregg, the guidebook author, having seen all the country from the Missouri to the Rio Grande, declared that the rich and beautiful uplands in the vicinity of Independence might well be denominated the garden spot of the Far West. Much of the best land, it happens, was already under cultivation. Moreover, it had been violently contested when, a decade earlier, the garden spot had been the setting for what were politely referred to as the Mormon difficulties. In 1831, only a few years after the founding of Independence, a small advance party of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints arrived on the scene and were at first regarded by the local citizenry as little more than harmless fanatics. But more followed. They bought land, founded a settlement and a ferry crossing on Blue River, opened their own general store in Independence, and established the town's first newspaper. Some began speaking out against slavery. In little time, seen as a threat, they were decried as the very dregs of the East, vicious, immoral, and, in education, little above the condition of our blacks. that they referred to the Indians across the border in Kansas Territory as their fellow tribes of Israel struck many hard-bitten old pioneers as close to insane. More ominous was their announced intention to become proprietors of the entire region. Joseph Smith, their prophet and leader, proclaimed Jackson County Holy Land and commanded that Independence become their City of Zion. By the summer of 1833, with the saints in the county numbering more than 1,000, or roughly a third of the population, it appeared they might control the fall elections. A mass meeting was called at the courthouse. Angry speeches were made, and a proclamation issued declaring Mormons no longer welcome. Violence quickly followed. A mob smashed the Mormon printing press. A Mormon bishop was tarred and feathered. On Halloween night, armed riders, without other warrant than their own judgment of the requirements of the situation, attacked the Mormon settlement on Blue River, driving women and children from their homes. Crops and barns went up in flame. Men were dragged into the fields and flogged. Jackson County was in a state of dreadful fermentation. In another clash, three men were killed. When, on the night of November 12th, the skies ignited in a spectacular meteor shower like none ever seen on the Missouri frontier, many took it as a sign to rid the land of Mormons once and for all. More than 1,000 people were forced from their homes and driven across the Missouri River into less settled territory to the north, where their persecutions only grew worse, but with the difference now that they fought back. The governor of Missouri, an independent storekeeper named Lilburn W. Boggs, called out the militia and declared that for the public good, all Mormons must leave the state or be exterminated. A religious war was underway, Missouri's first civil war, and ended only when the Mormons departed for Illinois in 1839. Such events were past history by the time Solomon Young and his small family arrived in 1841. Yet only a year later, in 1842, a lone assassin, a Mormon presumably, crept to a window in Independence and shot Lilburn W. Boggs, all but killing him. As favored by nature as the Blue River Country may have been, it was no peaceable kingdom. Nor was nature ever entirely benign in Missouri, as the new settlers learned soon enough. Winters could be severe, or marked by weeks of raw gloom when the whole country looked as grim and hard as iron. The cold cut to the bone. The diary of one farmer, though written years later, speaks for generations of Jackson County people. "Awful cold. I did not work today, too cold. Colder than it has been this year. I slept cold. Cloudy and wind blowing. I am chilly. Tremendous windy and cold. Cold, blue cold this morning. Too cold to work. Awful cold. All of us housed up, nobody stirring. I got very cold." It was a climate of great extremes, even in the span of a day. Temperatures could rise or drop 50 degrees in a matter of hours. Summers turned too dry or too wet, and either way were nearly always broiling hot. The year 1844 brought the worst floods on record, followed by a tornado that tore up trees and fences and killed a number of people. But then no one came to the frontier expecting things to go easily, least of all a farmer. Solomon and Harriet Louisa Young made their start on a farm known as the Parish Place, not far from the Missouri River and well within the projected outlines of Kansas City. Then shortly afterward, in 1844, possibly because of the flood, they made a first claim to public land on high ground back from the Blue River approximately 16 miles south of Independence, near the settlement of Hickman's Mills, on what was called Blue Ridge. It was high, fertile, well-drained ground, ideal grazing country, good for corn and wheat, as high and fine as any land in the county, with distant views miles into Kansas Territory. The first Blue Ridge claim comprised just 80 acres, the minimum purchase required by the Land Act, and Solomon Young paid $1.25 an acre, the minimum price for public land. To gain title, he was also obliged to occupy the land for a time, and consequently stories were passed down of how he and Harriet Louisa came there with a gun and an axe and two babies and a blanket. Grandchildren would listen to Harriet Louisa tell how Solomon rode off to file his claim in the land office at Clinton, 70 miles distant, and describe the nights she spent in a shelter of fence rails and brush alone with the two children, Susan Mary and William, who, if not exactly babies any longer, were still quite small. The family expanded, and so did Solomon's holdings. 6 more children were born: Sarah Ann, Harrison, Elizabeth, Laura Jane, Martha Ellen, and Ada, as ever larger parcels of land were acquired. A house and barn went up. Blue Ridge became the home place. Solomon's financial setbacks were frequent and might have crushed a less resilient spirit, but by reputation he was one of the best farmers and stockmen in the county, and in the long run he prospered. He had an eye for horses, he knew mules, he knew land, and he bought and sold either at every opportunity. In time, he established a trans-prairie freighting enterprise and amassed land holdings that for Jackson County amounted to a small empire. Indeed, by all accounts, Solomon Young was a remarkable man, and considerably more is known about him and Harriet Louisa than about Anderson or Mary Jane Truman. He was born in Shelby County, Kentucky, near the town of Simpsonville, in 1815, the year of Andrew Jackson's triumph at the Battle of New Orleans, which made him 26 when he came to Missouri. His father, Jacob Young, was a Revolutionary War veteran from North Carolina. His mother, Rachel Goodnight Young, died when he was 12. When his father remarried and moved on, Solomon was left to fend for himself, earning his keep weighing hogs and trading livestock. Full-grown, he was tall, powerful, self-reliant, bounding with energy, and a world-beating talker. Talk was nourishment for Solomon, as it never was for Harriet Louisa. Unlike so many who came out from Kentucky, he was neither Scotch-Irish nor a Baptist, but of German descent. The name had been spelled J-U-N-G in North Carolina, and only a nominal Methodist. Skeptical of preachers, or anyone who made too much show of religion, he liked to say that whenever he heard a man praying loudly, his first instinct was to go home and lock the smokehouse. Politics interested him not at all. Solomon had married Harriet Louisa Gregg in the second week of January 1838. She was Scotch-Irish, her people ardent members of Kentucky's first and largest Baptist congregation, the Long Run Baptist Church at Simpsonville, which had been built on land once owned by Abraham Lincoln's grandfather, Captain Abraham Lincoln. Her first child was born in 1839, her second, 2 years following, the same spring she and Solomon started west, which means she must have been nursing the baby on the boat trip up the Missouri. Remembered for her imperturbable disposition, no less than her abundant red hair, Harriet Louisa was not known to have complained or lost heart then or at any time afterward, whatever happened. She was a strong woman, and there wasn't a thing in the world that ever scared her, it would be said. Her last pregnancy was in 1856, but the baby did not survive. Nearly 40, she was well past middle age by the standards of the day, yet still short of midpoint in what was to be an extremely long, eventful life. Exactly when Solomon went west on the first of his wagon train expeditions, leaving Harriet Louisa in charge of everything, is not clear. It is known only that he went several times prior to the Civil War, beginning as early perhaps as 1846, the momentous year of the Mexican War and the trek of the Mormons out of Illinois to the Great Salt Lake, not to mention the year of Anderson Truman's arrival in Independence. Such undertakings were epic in scale in any event. The customary overland train was made up of 40 to 80 giant canvas-covered freight wagons, each requiring 6 yoke of oxen or mules and 2 drivers. A single wagon and team stretched 90 to 100 feet. And since the practice underway was to keep the wagons about 100 feet apart, some trains would be strung across the prairie for as far as 3 miles. To keep his bearings, Solomon carried a brass telescope, like a sea captain. The goods hauled could be worth a fortune, $30,000 or more, and the profits, if all went as planned, could be correspondingly large. Solomon, who at census time now listed himself as a freighter, appears to have done quite well. In 1850, his recorded wealth was $5,000. 10 years later, he was worth 10 times that. At age 35, he could count himself a wealthy man, with land and property valued at nearly $50,000. He is said to have owned as much as 5,000 acres, fancy blooded horses, and there was real silver on the table. Because the Santa Fe Trail first headed south out of Independence before swinging west across the Blue River, it passed within only a few miles of the Young Farm. Solomon would depart in the spring. Large and full-bearded, wearing a wide-brimmed hat, he must have been something to see as he pushed off, as his family saw him and remembered him, a man who could do pretty much anything he set his mind to. Once he started for California with a herd of 1,500 cattle. It took him a year, and he lost 500 cattle on the way, but he made it, through every kind of weather and hardship, across half the continent. At Sacramento, he traded the surviving herd for a ranch of 40,000 acres. But this, as the story goes, he was forced to sell to cover the debts of a partner. A man made good on his debts. A man stood by his friends. And a world-beating talker had a tale to tell his children, and they theirs. Another year, 1860, Solomon took 40 wagons to Utah, with goods and salt pork for the army. And his arrival at Salt Lake caused a stir. The wagons were coupled together in pairs, noted the August 16, 1860 edition of the Deseret News, one behind the other, each pair having on board about 6,000 pounds and drawn by 6 pairs of oxen. Mr. Young is of the opinion that the couple of 2 wagons together in that manner is the most economical way of freighting to this territory. Mr. Young's cattle look extremely well, and as we are informed, he did not lose a single ox by accident or otherwise during the trip. When the officer in charge at Salt Lake refused, for some reason, to receive the news, Solomon met with Brigham Young, who, though no relation, was a fellow Mason, and agreed to take the whole shipment if Solomon would extend him credit. The bargain worked out to the satisfaction of both. Meantime, Solomon also did a thriving trade in outfitting and advising emigrants bound for Oregon or Santa Fe, who now, every year, numbered in the thousands. But by 1849 and 1850, the years of the California Gold Rush and the greatest traffic through Independence, the little town's time in the sun was nearly over. For the same human tide brought virulent cholera. In the spring of 1849, 10 people died at the Noland House within a single day. In 1851, cholera struck again. In 1854, with no rain from June to November, crops failed all over the county. Scarlet fever, pneumonia, and cholera were epidemic the next several years. In the spring of 1857, the Youngs themselves lost a child, 9-year-old Elizabeth, who died of causes unrecorded. And all the while, across the line in Kansas, the old issue of slavery was building to a terrible storm that was to affect the lives and outlooks of nearly everyone in Jackson County for a very long time to come. Section 2. To many in western Missouri, the Civil War commenced not in 1861 with the attack on Fort Sumter in South Carolina, but in 1854, when Congress passed the fateful Kansas-Nebraska Act, leaving to the residents of the territories of Kansas and Nebraska the decision of whether to allow slavery. Missouri had come into the Union as a slave state following the famous Missouri Compromise of 1820 and 21, another congressional inspiration that admitted Maine, a free state, at the same time and prohibited slavery north of Missouri's southern border, latitude 36 degrees 30 minutes. Now, the old Missouri Compromise line was gone. The new bill, designed to ease tension, had exactly the opposite effect. What compounded the problem was the disproportionate size of the slave population along Missouri's western border, where possibly 50,000 slaves were held, which was nearly half the slaves in all Missouri. In Jackson County alone, there were more than 3,000, and their owners, whatever their feeling for the Union, dreaded the prospect of free territory so close, to which a slave might escape, or from which could come armed bands of slave liberators. For the owner, his slave was very often his most valuable possession, in addition to being vital to his livelihood. And as the chances of war increased, the monetary value of every slave increased steadily, to the point where a male in good health was worth $3,000, as much as 500 acres of prime land. Elsewhere in the nation, Kansas was seen as the issue that would settle things. "Come on, then, gentlemen of the slave states," said Senator William H. Seward of New York in a speech in Washington. "We will engage in competition for the virgin soil of Kansas, and God give the victory to the side that is stronger in numbers as it is in right." As if in answer, several thousand pro-slavery Missourians, "enough to kill every goddamned abolitionist in the territory," as one of their leaders expressed it, stormed over the border with guns and whiskey to help Kansas elect a pro-slavery legislature. In response, more free soilers poured in from the east, a new kind of emigrant traffic from which struggling little Kansas City began to benefit. When armed pro-slavery ruffians, later to be known as bushwhackers, tried to close passage on the Missouri by terrorizing the riverboats, the free soilers merely crossed overland through Iowa. Time, obviously, was running out. On May 22, 1856, hard-riding Missouri border ruffians shot up the town of Lawrence, Kansas, an abolitionist stronghold. 2 days afterward, a strange, wild-looking old man named John Brown, a new Kansas settler, decided the moment had come to regulate matters. Armed with broadswords honed to razor sharpness, Brown and his sons descended after dark on three isolated cabins on Little Pottawatomie Creek. There, they took five pro-slavery Kansas men and boys, none of whom had anything to do with the raid on Lawrence, and chopped them to pieces. "As declared by Almighty God," said John Brown. No sooner had the Free Soilers gained control in Kansas in the next round of elections than Kansas riders came charging over the line into Missouri to take their turn at murder and arson. For years before the Civil War began in the East, this terrible border war, civil war in every dreadful sense of the term, raged all up and down the Missouri-Kansas line and continued until the surrender at Appomattox. It was like some horrible chapter out of the Middle Ages, with gangs of brigand horsemen roaming the land. They could appear out of nowhere any time, led often by men who were no better than young thugs, some possibly deranged, like the bantam-sized Doc Jennison, whose outlaw Kansans were called Jayhawkers or Redlegs for their red leather leggings, or the Missouri guerrilla Bloody Bill Anderson, who liked to mutilate his victims. It was a war of plunder, ambush, and unceasing revenge. Nobody was safe. Defenseless towns were burned. Osceola, Missouri, and Shawneetown, Kansas, were all but wiped from the map. Neither then nor later did the rest of the country realize the extent of the horrors. Nor was it ever generally understood that most Missourians remained loyal to the Union, including slaveholders like Solomon Young and Anderson Truman, or that most Missourians bore no resemblance to the infamous bushwhackers. The popular picture of all Western Missourians as gun-slinging, whiskey-swilling riffraff was grossly inaccurate, as inaccurate as the idea that every Kansan was a transplanted, upright New England abolitionist. Atrocities were committed on both sides, and it was innocent civilians who suffered most. As one Kansan later said, "The devil came to the border, liked it, and decided to stay a while." Jackson County became the burnt country. Judge Henry Younger of Lee's Summit saw his farm destroyed during Jayhawker Doc Jennison's first sweep through the county, and Judge Younger was a Union man. Later, he was brutally murdered, which led his hot-blooded son Coleman, or Cole, to join up with the celebrated Missouri guerrilla chief, William Quantrill. A Jackson County physician named Lee was gunned down in cold blood because his sons had joined the Confederate Army. John Hagen, a farmer, was stopped by Union cavalry while out for a Sunday drive with his family. Ordered to get down from the wagon, he was led into the woods and shot through the head for no known reason. Christopher Mann, the prolific old Kentucky pioneer who had the ability of holding his breath for a minute and a half, was made to stand by at gunpoint and watch his farm burned by Missouri guerrillas. "They asked me if I was not a black abolitionist, and when I told them, 'I am a Union man, sir,' one of the bushwhackers struck me with his revolver and broke out two of my teeth." A first battle of independence was fought before dawn the morning of August 11, 1862, when Quantrill and his ragtag band came screaming into the square and a uniformed Confederate force overran a sleeping Union camp. In a second battle 2 years later, another Confederate victory, fierce block-to-block fighting raged back and forth across town for 2 days. The worst atrocity, the unpardonable Lawrence Massacre, was committed by Quantrill, a brave, ingenious, wretched man who was continuously in and out of Jackson County, hiding in the heavy brush of the winding Blue River bottoms. To most slaveholders, Quantrill was a hero, and in memory, in after years in Jackson County, he would acquire a romantic glow, an aura like that of no other figure of the war, as if he had been the very soul of Old South gallantry in service of the cause. In reality, he came from Ohio, nor had he ever shown any Southern sympathies or convictions until the killing began. At first light, the morning of August 21, 1863, with a force of nearly 500 men riding under a black silk flag, Quantrill struck Lawrence, Kansas. Most of the town was still asleep. His orders were to kill every man big enough to carry a gun and to burn the town. When it was over, at least 150 men and boys had been murdered. The day was clear and still, and smoke from the inferno rising in tremendous black columns could be seen from miles away. Like many others in Jackson County, Solomon and Harriet Louisa had a personal tie to the bushwhackers. Their third child, Sarah Ann, had married a man named James J. Childs, a highly unsavory character known as Jim Crow Childs. He was the dark side of frontier life, a future skeleton for the young Truman family closet. Jim Crow, whose nickname was said to have been bestowed in boyhood for his exuberant performance of a popular dance called the Jim Crow Set, belonged to one of the original pioneer families in the county, and large landholders, which initially stood him well with the Youngs. But in 1857, Jim Crow had killed a man in the bar at the Noland House, a stranger who had done no more than remark on his table manners. Another man who traveled with Jim Crow to Santa Fe shortly afterward remembered him as often good-natured, even jovial, but subject to violent fits of anger, and when angry, a very dangerous man. Tried for murder at the Independence Courthouse in 1859, he got off, the standing of the Childs family weighing heavily in the jury's decision, and it was almost immediately afterward that he and Sarah Ann, or Sally, were married. She was 16. Jim Crow, a dashing fellow, was notable for his dark eyes and powerful symmetrical build. At the onset of the war, Jim Crow took off with Quantrill and Bloody Bill Anderson and quickly demonstrated that, like them, he enjoyed killing, always exhibiting the traits of the most inhuman savage, as a Kansas City paper would write at the time of his death. He was an active participant, for example, in the capture of Union Captain Daniel H. David on the Little Blue, when Captain David and his men were hacked to death John Brown style. In this pitiless onrush of history, the Youngs, too, were caught in the middle no less than anyone along the border. And their stories of what happened, of all that was taken and destroyed, would be told repeatedly, some events merging in memory with others as time passed, some details being dropped or made a touch more vivid than the truth, perhaps, depending on who was telling the story to whom and when. Whether, for example, the fanatical Grim Chieftain of Kansas, Jim Lane, struck the Young farm the summer of 1861, 2 years before the Lawrence massacre, as Lane headed through Missouri to burn Osceola, or whether it was earlier, just after the war officially began in the spring of 1861, is a matter of some confusion. But there's no doubt that he came, or that Solomon was somewhere far afield on one of his expeditions. Solomon may have reasoned that since he was an avowed Union man, his family would be safe. Will Young, the oldest son, was also absent. Will had joined the Confederate Army, which left Harriet Louisa alone with the children. In a theater of war characterized by strange, terrifying human apparitions, James Henry Lane may have been the strangest, most terrifying of all. Tall, gaunt, always wildly disheveled even in uniform, he had a sallow, hatchet face, atrociously bad teeth, and a voice with a raspy, unearthly sound. He was also a brilliant orator and a rampant political opportunist. As an overnight fire-eating Republican, he had been elected as one of the first two senators from the new state of Kansas. Arriving in Washington on the eve of the war, he organized a frontier guard to protect Abraham Lincoln, and for a few nights he and his men actually bivouacked in the east room of the executive mansion. In Missouri, he was known as a freedom soldier, meaning he would free you of anything he could lay his hands on. Food, forage, money, silk dresses, the family silver, even a piano on occasion. Everybody knew about Jim Lane. He was as feared and reviled on the Missouri side of the line as was Quantrill in Kansas. For Harriet Louisa, there could have been no mistaking who it was in Union blue riding up the road. In the formal claim she filed in 1902, more than 35 years after the war, it is recorded that Union forces under five different officers came to the farm on five different occasions, beginning with General Lane in May 1861. All that they took or destroyed is itemized. If the record is accurate, then Lane was accountable only for 15 mules and 13 horses, valued at $4,525. But by Harriet Louisa's own recollection on numerous occasions before and after the report was filed, as well as the stories repeated by those of her children who were witness to the same events, this is what happened. Lane and his Kansans proceeded to shoot 400 Hampshire hogs, then cut out only the hams, leaving the rest to rot. Harriet Louisa was ordered to bake biscuits, which she did until her hands blistered. Some of the soldiers passed the time playing cards in the yard, sitting in the mud on her best hand-sewn quilt. Others, out of sheer cussedness, blasted away at her hens. Whether Lane knew of the family's connection to Jim Crow Chiles or the fact that Will Young had joined the Confederates is not known. But, to determine the whereabouts of Solomon Young, the Kansans took the man of the place, 15-year-old Harrison, looped a rope about his neck, threw the other end over a tree, and said they would hang him if he didn't tell where his father was hiding. Harrison, according to the story, told the truth, saying Solomon had gone west with a wagon train. They tightened the rope, stretching his neck, and asked again. Harrison answered as before. Then, suddenly, bored with their game, the men let him go. Hay barns were set ablaze. Lane and the rest rode off, taking the hams, biscuits, feather beds, and the family silver. According to Harriet Louisa's formal claim, however, it was a Colonel Burris, not Lane, who made off with 1,200 pounds of bacon in October of 1862, as well as 65 tons of hay, 500 bushels of corn, 44 head of hogs, two horses, one with bridle and saddle, one lot of beds and bedding, seven wagons, and 30,000 fence rails. A General Sturgis was also responsible for taking 150 head of cattle, and a Captain Axeline for 13,000 fence rails, 1,000 bushels of corn, and 6,000 rations. The total value of everything confiscated came to $21,442, the equivalent in present-day money of $250,000. Interestingly, no family silver is listed, nor is there any reference to buildings destroyed. Yet the theft of the family silver by old Jim Lane would be talked of repeatedly in after years, and Martha Ellen Young, who was 9 at the time, would one day describe for a New York Times writer how she and her mother, their faces blackened with the soot and ash that rained down from the burning barns, stood in the yard watching the hated blue soldiers ride away. Though possibly no silver ever was taken, certainly it might have been. And if no buildings were actually destroyed on the young farm, the little girl may well have been witness to other farms going up in flames in the burnt country. The resulting hatred was the same in any event. The stories were what mattered as they were passed along, not the formal claim. From such times and memories, as was said, a family got solid in its feelings. But nothing that happened in western Missouri during the course of the war left such a legacy of bitterness as the infamous Union measure known as General Order No. 11. Estimating that two-thirds of the outlying Missouri populace were either kin to the guerrillas, like the Youngs, or actively and heartily engaged in feeding, clothing, and sustaining them, like the Slaughter family, near neighbors of the Youngs on Blue Ridge, the Union commander at Kansas City, Brigadier General Thomas Ewing, decided to deny the guerrillas their base of supply by depopulating the entire area. The order was issued August 25, 1863. All civilians in Jackson, Cass, and Bates counties, except those living within a mile of Union posts at Kansas City, Independence, Hickman's Mills, Pleasant Hill, and Harrisonville, were to remove from their present places of residence within 15 days. If they could prove their loyalty to the Union to the satisfaction of the post commander, they could remain in those towns or cross over into Kansas. If not, they must leave Missouri. All grain and hay found in the district after the deadline was to be destroyed. 20,000 people were driven from their homes. The country was depopulated in a matter of weeks, as Union cavalry helped themselves to whatever of value was left behind, then put a torch to buildings and crops. "It is heart-sickening to see what I have seen," wrote a Union officer to his wife. "A desolated country, and men and women and children, some of them almost naked, some on foot and some in old wagons. Oh, God!" Another Union officer, appalled by the suffering he witnessed firsthand, was the artist George Caleb Bingham, whose outrage would take form after the war when, settling in Independence, he painted Order No. 11, in which General Ewing himself would be seen driving a family from their home. At the Young farm, the policy appears to have been carried out to the letter, despite the fact that Solomon had signed a loyalty oath more than a year before. The family was permitted to take away one wagon load of possessions. Little Martha Ellen would remember trudging northward on a hot, dusty road behind the swaying wagon, headed for bitter exile in Kansas City. Anderson Truman, meantime, had fared far better. He, too, had signed a loyalty oath. He wanted only the Union as it was, like the rest of the Trumans back in Kentucky. "I hope you have not turned against this glorious Union," wrote his brother John Truman from Shelby County, where, as in Missouri, families and neighbors were sharply divided. But earlier, Anderson and his family had moved across the Missouri to Platte County, which, close as it was, the war hardly touched. An increasingly religious man, he wished no part in violence. He hated Catholics, but little else, apparently, and he kept to his land and labors, living simply and almost without incident. Once, after dark, the slave Hannah heard screams and a commotion of horses at the adjoining farm. Everyone assumed the Red Legs had arrived, and Grandmother Holmes, then in her 80s, fled with the youngest Truman children to hide in a cornfield. The Red Legs proved to be a detachment of Confederate cavalry who had come to press a neighbor's sons into service. This was as close as the war ever came to the Trumans. The children numbered 5, 3 girls, Margaret, Emma, and Mary, and 2 boys, William and John, neither of whom was old enough to fight in the war. When it was all over in April 1865, Anderson loaded his 5 slaves, Hannah, Marge, and their 3 daughters, into a big farm wagon with a month's supply of food and drove them to Leavenworth, Kansas, the place they had chosen to begin their freedom. When he returned to Leavenworth some years later to learn what had become of them, nobody knew. "They never bought one, they never sold one," a keeper of the family annals would later conclude, speaking somewhat defensively of the Anderson Trumans and their slaves. The wounds of nearly 9 years of war in Missouri were a long time healing. While most veterans of the defeated Confederate Army took up life as best they could, married, and settled down, others found it impossible to return to anything like the old ways. Cole Younger turned desperado, and with his brothers joined forces with 2 more who had fought with Quantrill, Frank and Jesse James. The gang held up its first bank on the main square of Little Liberty, Missouri, about 10 miles from Independence as the crow flies, in February 1866. Later, they hit upon the novel idea of robbing trains. Closer to home was the case of Jim Crow Chiles, who for years conducted his own one-man reign of terror, using a notorious gambling hall in Kansas City called Headquarters as a base of operations. Having made himself leader of the toughest element in that now wide-open town, he swaggered about armed with 2 heavy dragoon revolvers, 2 pocket derringers, and a black snake whip that became his trademark. His home was in Independence, where he owned a livery stable and kept a pack of bloodhounds that bayed half the night, but that nobody ever dared complain about. He was universally hated, the kind of town bully who figured in children's nightmares. To black people, he was a living terror. On drinking sprees, he would mount a horse and hunt them down with his whip. It's recorded that he killed 2 black men in cold blood on 2 different occasions in Independence, shot them to see them jump. Reportedly, he had killed 9 men altogether and was under indictment for 3 murders by the time a deputy marshal named James Peacock decided to stand up to him as no one ever had. Both men were heavily armed, and both accompanied by a young son, also armed, the morning of the confrontation on the west side of the courthouse square. September 21st, 1873, was a Sunday, and a number of people on hand witnessed everything. Advancing on Peacock, Jim Crow challenged him to fight, then hit him in the face. Peacock struck back, and at once they tore into each other with fists and pistols, pell-mell in the dust of the street, the 2 boys plunging in. Jim Crow's son, Elijah, had eyesight so poor he was nearly blind, yet he never hesitated. Shots were fired. Jim Crow was hit in the shoulder, Peacock in the back. Elijah, too, was hit. Then Peacock fired point-blank into Jim Crow's face, killing him instantly. Jim Crow's body was carried to the Noland House, to the same bar room where he had killed his first man. The boy Elijah died the next night. Peacock, however, survived, a bullet lodged in his spine, and as the sheriff who killed Jim Crow Chiles, he became a county legend and unbeatable at election time, the Chiles family meanwhile having publicly exonerated him from any blame. For the Youngs, as for the Chileses, it was a tragedy of terrible proportions, and one they refused to discuss then or later, though it is said Solomon Young cursed his daughter Sally, and that Martha Ellen, her father's pet, burned a portrait of Jim Crow. Sally, a widow at 30, was expecting another child. Her son, Elijah, had been all of 13. Section 3. For Martha Ellen Young, Matt or Matty as she was known, life had picked up again 3 years after the war in 1868, the year she turned 17 and the family resettled on Blue Ridge in a new, more spacious house. Harriet Louisa had chosen the spot. The new house faced west at the end of a straight quarter-mile drive lined with double rows of elm trees that Matty helped her father plant. The house, wood frame and painted white with green shutters, had a wide front veranda and two large square front parlors off a central hall. Dining room and kitchen were in a wing to the rear, this enclosed by more porches. Beyond, to the rear, past the orchard, stood a huge red barn built entirely of heavy walnut planks and beams taken from the old original mill at Hickman's Mills. The immediate farm comprised 600 acres, with fields bound by squarely built limestone walls, rock fences as they were known. Whatever his losses from the war, Solomon appears to have taken hold again. Matt had her pick of several fine saddle horses, and would spend some of the happiest days of her life riding side saddle over the high open land. If she never learned to milk a cow, her father advised, she would never have to milk a cow. So she never learned. She did learn to bake and sew, and to use a rifle as well as a man. If she swept the veranda, she made the broom fly. Lively is the adjective that turns up in old correspondence to describe Matty Young. Presently, she was sent away to the Lexington Baptist Female College in sedate, tree-shaded Lexington, Missouri, where for 2 years she learned to sketch, play the piano, and acquired a lifelong love of books and the poetry of Alexander Pope. Of above-average height, about 5'6", she was a slender young woman with dark hair, a round, bright face, and a way of looking directly at people with her clear, gray-blue eyes. Like her father, whom she adored, she was inclined also to speak her mind. Life on the farm, meantime, had returned to the old rhythms of seasons and crops and work. Talk at the dinner table was of hog prices and taxes, of the Mormons who had begun returning to the county from Utah, convinced still that independence was their city of Zion, and of the new Hannibal Bridge at Kansas City, the first railroad bridge over the Missouri, which promised to change everything. Kansas City was growing beyond anyone's dreams. The bridge was finished in 1869, the year of the opening of the Transcontinental Railroad. By 1872, just 3 years later, there were 7 railroad lines in and out of Kansas City. The days of steamboats and wagon trains were all but vanished. Missouri, as one was supposed to pronounce it, was no longer the far west, but the great center of the country. In the summer of 1874, grasshoppers came in black clouds that shut out the sky. When they were gone, the land was as bare as if scorched by fire. The following year they came again, as if to mock the progress people talked about. The social occasions Matty Young loved best were the dances at home in the front parlors or at neighboring farms. She was a spirited dancer, a light-foot Baptist. One winter, after a blizzard, there was a dance every night for a week. Neighbors would dance most of the night, then spend the following day riding in big box sleighs cross-country to the next house. Possibly it was on such a night that she first met John Truman, who since the end of the war had returned with his family to Jackson County and taken up farming nearby. In any event, They seem to have known one another for some time before announcing their plans to marry in 1881, by which time Mattie was 29. John Anderson Truman, who was a year older, had had no education beyond a rural school, and except for the night during the war when he fled with Grandmother Holmes into the cornfield, he had had no known adventures. Nor had he any special skills or money. None of the Trumans had ever had money. Still, he was ambitious. He aspired to be a stock trader like Solomon Young, and he was a hard worker, cheerful, eager to please. He loved to sing while Mattie played the piano. He also had a violent temper, though thus far this had landed him in no trouble. Overall, he made a good impression. In a thick new History of Jackson County, Missouri, published the year he and Matt were married, it was said of John Truman that he resides with his father and manages the farm. He is an industrious and energetic young man, and one that bids fair to make a success in life. His mother, Mary Jane Truman, had died 2 years before in 1879. The indomitable Nancy Tyler Holmes was also in her grave by this time, having lived to age 94. Appearances would always matter greatly to John Truman. For his wedding photograph taken in Kansas City, he wore a white string tie, kid gloves, and a black frock coat. His boots were gleaming, his thin reddish-brown hair clipped and plastered to perfection. He also chose to be seated for the picture, it is said, because he was sensitive about his height. At 5'4", he was 2 inches shorter than Mattie. She stood beside him in brocaded satins and a wide lace collar, her hair parted in the middle and brushed smoothly back in the current fashion, her left hand resting on his shoulder, her eyes, like his, directly on the camera. As a wedding gift, Solomon gave her a 3-drawer burl walnut dresser, with a marble top and a mirror, with small side shelves. She was never to own another piece of furniture quite so fine. The ceremony took place at the home place 3 days after Christmas, December 28, 1881. The couple's own first home was in Lamar, Missouri, a dusty, wind-blown market town and county seat, Barton County, 90 miles due south. For $685, John became the proud owner of a corner lot and a white frame house measuring all of 20 by 28 feet, which was hardly more than the dimensions of the Young's kitchen. It had 6 tiny rooms, no basement, no running water, and no plumbing. But it was new, snug and sunny, with a casement window in the parlor on the southern side. For another $200, John bought a barn diagonally across the street, and there he opened for business. His announcement in the Lamar Democrat reading as follows: "Mules bought and sold. I will keep for sale at the White Barn on Kentucky Avenue a lot of good mules. Anyone wanting teams will do well to call on J. A. Truman." A spinster sister, Mary Martha Truman, who, like John's father, came for an extended stay, considered Lamar the end of the world. The place made her miserable, yet Mattie, she observed, remained lively as ever. Mattie's first child, a boy, was stillborn the couple's first autumn in Lamar. A year and a half later, a second child, a boy, was born in a bedroom off the parlor so small there was barely space for the bed. The attending physician, Dr. W. L. Griffin, received a fee of $15, and to celebrate the occasion, the new father planted a seedling pine in the front yard. A story that John Truman also nailed a mule shoe over the front door for luck is apocryphal. The date was May 8, 1884. 2 days later, a Baptist circuit rider, took the baby out into the spring air and, holding him up in the sunshine, remarked what a sturdy boy he was. Not for a month afterward, however, did Dr. Griffin bother to register the birth at the county clerk's office up the street. And even then, the child was entered nameless. In a quandary over a middle name, Mattie and John were undecided whether to honor her father or his. In the end, they compromised with the letter S. It could be taken to stand for Solomon or ship, but actually stood for nothing, a practice not unknown among the Scotch-Irish even for first names. The baby's first name was Harry, after his uncle Harrison. Harry S. Truman he would be. The child would have no memory of Lamar or the house where he was born, for shortly afterward John Truman sold out and moved everybody north again, to a farm near Harrisonville, only 7 miles from the young place. The earliest written description of Harry Truman is in a letter from Harrisonville dated April 7, 1885, when he was still less than a year old. "Baby is real sick now," wrote John's sister Mary Martha. "He is so cross we can't do anything." The mule business at Lamar had been disappointing, and so apparently was the Harrisonville farm, for the Trumans remained there even less time, only 2 years, during which a second son was born, John Vivian Truman, named for his father and a popular Confederate cavalry officer, John Vivian, who was to be known henceforth as Vivian. Of these Harrisonville years, little Harry would remember just 2 incidents. His earliest memory, interestingly, was of laughter. He was chasing a frog around the yard, laughing every time it jumped. To Grandmother Young, who had observed so many children, so splendid a sense of humor in a 2-year-old was quite remarkable. The second memory was of his mother, for fun, dropping him from an upstairs window into the outstretched arms of his very large Uncle Harry, who was to be a popular favorite from then on. Solomon Young, by now in his 70s and among the most respected men in the county, was still fit and active. It seemed nothing could touch him, not wars or epidemics or advancing years. But in 1887, the John Truman family moved back to the Young farm, and John became Solomon's partner. To what extent John's 2 false starts influenced the decision, or how much say Mattie had, can only be imagined. Thus, it was to be the Young home place where small Harry S. Truman made most of his earliest observations of the world, beginning at age 3. Grandfather Anderson Truman also moved in. He was given a room of his own upstairs, and a place was found for one of the fatherless child's grandchildren, Cousin Saul. Counting everybody, Harrison, who remained a bachelor, Sister Ada, a hired girl, several hired hands, and nearly always a visiting relative or stray neighbor child, this made a household of seldom less than 14 or 15 people spanning 3 generations, all under one roof, on the same Blue Ridge where Solomon and Harriet Louisa had made their claim so many years before. Chapter 2. Model Boy. "Now, Harry, you be good." Martha Ellen Truman. Section 1. Harry Truman liked to say in later years that he had the happiest childhood imaginable. Grandpa Young took him riding over the countryside in a high-wheeled cart behind a strawberry roan trotting horse. Grandpa adored him, the boy knew. One summer, every day for a week, they drove 6 miles to the Belton Fair and sat together in the judge's stand watching the races and eating striped candy. It was the best time a kid ever had. Grandpa was quite a man, a great big man, with a flowing white beard and strong hands. Until Mama gave birth to a third child, the boy's only competition for attention was little Vivian, who still wore his hair in curls. On a day nearly as memorable as those at the Belton Fair, Grandpa and he conspired to give Vivian a haircut, sitting him up in a high chair on the south porch. Mama was furious when she discovered what they had done, but amazingly she said nothing, so unassailable was Grandpa's authority. The porch where the haircut took place overlooked a broad bluegrass pasture with a creek where the boys were allowed to explore on their own, accompanied by a black and tan dog of uncertain ancestry called Tandy and a cat named Bob. Harry would also remember a swing under an old elm close to the house, and another swing indoors in the front hall for rainy days. The long porch on the north side of the house made a perfect racetrack for their red express wagon. They went hunting for bird nests and gathered wild strawberries in prairie grass as tall as they. The farm was a wonderful place. These were wonderful days and great adventures. The young land seemed to go on and on. A few miles beyond the immediate farm, with its 600 acres, was a second farm owned by Grandpa, this with nearly 1,000 acres. There were herds of cattle, saddle horses, draft horses, mules, sheep, hogs, chickens, ducks, and geese. Harry's father presented him with a black Shetland pony and a new saddle. With the pony on a lead, he let the boy ride beside him as he made his rounds. "I became familiar with every sort of animal on the farm," Harry wrote long afterward, "and watched the wheat harvest, the threshing and the corn shucking, mowing and stacking hay, and every evening at supper time heard my father tell a dozen farmhands what to do." It was a time of self-contained security and plenty, such as the Trumans were not to know again. Most marvelous in memory for Harry was the abundance of food. Dried apples, peaches, candy, and nuts of all kinds, wonderful cookies, pies, corn pudding, roasting ears in summer. There were peach butter, apple butter, grape butter, jellies and preserves, he would write, all produced in a big crowded kitchen by Grandma Young and a German hired girl. Following the late autumn freeze and hog-killing time came homemade sausages, souse, pickled pig's feet, and lard rendered in a tremendous iron kettle, said to have been too heavy for old Jim Lane to carry away. From his Aunt Ada, the boy learned to play euchre. Uncle Harry told amusing stories and taught him a card game called Coon Can, a form of gin rummy then more popular than poker. Though Uncle Harry, the bachelor uncle, had forsaken farming for the bedazzlements of Kansas City, he returned often, bringing candy and toys. Like Grandpa Young, he was a big man, over 6 feet tall, strong as a wrestler, good-humored, handsome. And like Grandpa Young, he made Harry feel he was somebody particular because he was named for him. When he came, it was just like Christmas. The child liked everybody, to judge by his later recollections. Cousin Saul Chiles, then in his teens and often surly and difficult, would be remembered as somebody who really made life pleasant. Saul's mother, Aunt Sally, was a lovely person. Aunt Laura, another frequent visitor from Kansas City, was somebody we always enjoyed. Yet life had its troubles and woes. On the summer day when his grandfather Truman died, 3-year-old Harry had rushed to the bed to pull at the old man's beard, trying desperately to wake him. Climbing on a chair sometime afterward, in an attempt to comb his hair in front of a mirror, he toppled over backward and broke his collarbone. Another time, he would have choked to death on a peach stone had his mother not responded in a flash and decisively, pushing the stone down his throat with her finger instead of trying to pull it out. Later, when Grandpa Young lay sick in bed and the little boy approached cautiously to inquire how he was feeling, the old pioneer, fixing him with a wintry stare, said, "How are you feeling? You're the one I'm worried about." It was Mama, Harry decided, who understood him best. She was brighter than anyone, he thought, and cared most about his well-being. Holding him in her lap while explaining the large print in the family Bible, she taught him to read before he was 5. Then, the summer of 1889, following his 5th birthday, Mama surprised him with a baby sister, of whom nothing had been said in advance. From the sound of crying upstairs, he and Vivian thought a new pet had arrived. The baby was named Mary Jane, after John Truman's mother, the grandmother they had never known. And to Harry, she was a miracle. He adored her. It was Mama also, a year later, who hustled him off to Kansas City for expensive eyeglasses. Though he had been badly handicapped by poor eyesight all along, blind as a mole, in his words, no one seems to have noticed until the night of a July 4th fireworks when Matt saw him responding more to the sound of the sky rockets than to the spectacle overhead. The Kansas City optometrist diagnosed a rare malformation called flat eyeballs, hypermetropia, which means the boy was farsighted, and Matt agreed to a pair of double-strength, wire-rimmed spectacles at a cost of $10. All at once the world was transformed for him, as if by magic, and as quickly he became a curiosity, small boys with eyeglasses being almost unknown in rural Missouri. Her heart went out to him, Matt later said, but she was determined not to pamper. While Grandma Young gave every youngster free rein, Mama taught that punishment followed transgression. She had a switch, and she would use it. When Harry led Vivian and another child on an expedition to a waterhole in the south pasture to spend a glorious afternoon plastering each other with mud, she punished Harry severely and Harry alone for being the ringleader. But more painful by far were Papa's occasional outbursts. For though John Truman never spanked, never laid a hand in anger on any of his children, which seems remarkable for a man of such known temper, his scoldings were enough to burn the hide off. One incident was never forgotten. His father had been leading him on the pony when Harry fell off, only to be told that any boy who could not stay on a pony at a walk must walk himself. Harry cried all the way back to the house, where Mama let it be known she thought he had been unjustly treated. Still more change followed in the summer of 1890, the summer of the eyeglasses, when Mama announced they were leaving the farm, moving to Independence, so that Harry could receive proper schooling. With money inherited from his father, John Truman acquired a house and several lots on South Chrysler Avenue, close to the Missouri Pacific Railroad tracks. At age 40, having attained nothing like the success forecast in the Jackson County history, John had decided to try again as a stock trader. He paid $1,000 down for house and land and took out a mortgage for $3,000, certain he had made a good bargain with the owner, Samuel Blitz, one of the few Jews in town. For Harry, whose world through the new eyeglasses had only just come into focus, the next few years were to be a time of great adjustment. In 1892, Solomon Young died at age 77. Less than a year later, a black servant girl trying to light a coal oil lamp accidentally ignited a fire that burned the young house to the ground. Practically nothing was saved. And though a small house, intended as a temporary replacement, was put up on the same spot for Grandma Young, and Uncle Harrison returned to help manage things, the old way of life at the home place was over. The one personal possession of Grandpa Young's to survive the disaster was the brass telescope from his days on the plains, which he had given to Matt some time before. 9-year-old Harry's feelings at the time of his Grandfather Young's death went unrecorded. But in later years he would talk often of the big man in his background, who had made his own way in the world on nerve and will, who had seen the great West when it was still wild, who played a part in history, and who, of course, came home always to Missouri. With such a grandfather, a boy could hardly imagine himself a nobody. He appears to have liked school from the start. He liked his first grade teacher, Miss Myra Ewan. He liked his second grade teacher, Miss Minnie Ward. He liked all his teachers, by his later account. "I do not remember a bad teacher in all my experience," he would reflect, and learned quickly how to make them like him. In this, he felt he had quite a knack. He made a study of people, he remembered. "When I was growing up, it occurred to me to watch the people around me to find out what they thought and what pleased them most. I used to watch my father and mother closely to learn what I could do to please them, just as I did with my school teachers and playmates." It was thus, by getting along with people, he discovered, that he could nearly always get what he wanted. By all surviving evidence, he was an exceptionally alert, good little boy of sunny disposition, who, with the glasses that so greatly magnified his blue eyes, looked as bright and interested as could be. Myra Ewan, the first-grade teacher, remembered never having to reprimand him. "He just smiled his way along," she said. A report card for second grade shows him consistently in the 90s in spelling, reading, and deportment. His lowest grade for the first marking period was an 86 in writing. Naturally left-handed, he was being taught to use his right hand. But by the third marking period, he had brought that up to a 90, while for both language and arithmetic, he received a perfect 100%. The fourth marking period is missing, because in midwinter, early in 1894, both he and Vivian came down with diphtheria. And though Vivian recovered quickly, Harry took a dramatic turn for the worse. He became paralyzed in his legs and arms and could only lie helplessly. For months, Matt wheeled him about in a baby carriage, until abruptly, miraculously, he recovered, and from that point on was seldom sick again. When it was suggested to Vivian years later that his mother had to have been terribly frightened by the crisis, he said she didn't scare easy. Tutored through the summer, Harry made such progress that he was allowed to skip third grade and go directly into fourth. By now, also, he was reading everything I could get my hands on, histories and encyclopedias and everything else. For his 10th birthday in the spring of 1894, his mother presented him with a set of large illustrated volumes grandly titled in gold leaf, Great Men and Famous Women. He would later count the moment as one of life's turning points. There were four volumes: Soldiers and Sailors, Statesmen and Sages, Workmen and Heroes, and Artists and Authors. They were not books for children, but anthologies of essays from Harper's and other leading American and English magazines. The subjects, numbering in the hundreds, ranged from Moses to Grover Cleveland. The authors included Edward Everett Hale on Goethe, Lord Macaulay on Samuel Johnson, H. Rider Haggard on Cortez, and young Theodore Roosevelt on Winfield Scott. Harry would eventually plow his way through all of them, soldiers and sailors appealing especially. He dreamed of becoming a great general. He loved best the story of Hannibal, who had only one eye. "There is not in all history," he read, "so wonderful an example of what a single man of genius may achieve against tremendous odds." Of the American heroes, his favorites, not surprisingly, were Andrew Jackson and Robert E. Lee, who was his mother's idol. It was to be worthy of her, he would one day confide to a friend, that he studied the careers of great men. Included in the Lee biography was a letter from Lee to his son written in 1860. Though she could never have found the words, it was what Matt herself might have written to the boy as the new century approached. "You must be frank with the world. Frankness is the child of honesty and courage. Say just what you mean to do on every occasion and take it for granted you mean to do right. Never do anything wrong to make a friend or keep one. The man who requires you to do so is dearly purchased at a sacrifice. Deal kindly but firmly with all your classmates. You will find it the policy which wears best. Above all, do not appear to others what you are not." Matt and John Truman both wanted books in the house. John kept loose change in a tray from an old steamer trunk to save for a set of Shakespeare. Harry would never recall being bored. "Not once," he said, "because we had a house full of books." He read the Bible twice through by the time he was 12, he later claimed, pored over Plutarch's Lives, a gift from his father, and in time to come read all of the new set of Shakespeare. The reading was not something you talked about outside the house, he explained. It was just something you did. Home now was a white clapboard carpenter's plan book house, not unlike a number of others in Independence, except for a cupola with a gilded rooster weather vane. Sloping away at the back was an unusually deep lot of several acres, where John Truman, an avid gardener, grew strawberries and vegetables, and kept cows, horses, and whatever livestock he happened to be trading at the moment, which could be a surprising number. For a time, there were no fewer than 500 goats quartered on the property. Trying to sink a well, he hit natural gas, with which he heated both his house and that of a neighbor. It was a rare piece of good luck for John Truman. Beyond the back fence, about 150 yards or so distant, was the Missouri Pacific Depot. While on the north side of the house, the main tracks ran so close the trains would rattle the kitchen dishes. The soot and noise were something for Matt to contend with, not to say the smell of 500 goats. Harry was fascinated by trains, and daily a total of 23 went by. He would sit alone on the roof of the coal shed behind the house counting freight cars, or on winter nights, awake in his bed, listen for the eastbound Kansas-Nebraska Limited, which made no stop at Independence and began shrieking its warning whistle miles beyond town. "Harry, do you remember how much you loved the trains?" his cousin Ethel Noland would ask years afterward. "I still do," he said. First and second grade were at the Noland School on South Liberty Street, which was a long walk. But when the new 8-room Columbian School opened on South River Boulevard, he had only to go 3 blocks. He kept to himself more than most boys his age, and in later years he would speak feelingly of the isolation of childhood. "It's a very lonely thing being a child." He seldom played games. He was afraid of the rough and tumble of the schoolyard, and because of his glasses, felt incapable of any sport that involved a moving ball. He much preferred being at home. To help with the cooking and washing, the family now employed a woman named Caroline Simpson, who was, black as your hat, and who with her husband, Letch, and four children, lived with the Trumans. Caroline Simpson taught Harry to cook on the big wood stove and talked to him by the hour. He liked the warmth and chatter of the kitchen, liked to look after his little sister. He would sit with her in a rocking chair for hours at a time, braiding her hair or singing her to sleep. No one was ever so nice to her as her brother Harry, Mary Jane would say in later years. Outside in the yard, he never took his eyes off her, afraid she might hurt herself as he once had. The cellar door had slammed on his foot and cut off the end of his big toe. Mama had rushed to the rescue, found the severed piece, and held it in place until the doctor arrived to secure it with a coating of crystalline iodoform and a bandage. For a small boy, he was also abnormally neat and clean. John Truman was the kind of father who wanted everything looking just so. Grass clipped around fence posts, horses slicked up, and his children turned out in like fashion. But in a photo of Harry made in Kansas City when he was 13 and about to enter high school, he looks not just spotless, every detail in order, but like a boy who will stay that way. He was never popular like other boys, never one of the fighters, as he called them. Reminiscing long afterward, he spoke of the teasing he endured because of his glasses. "To tell the truth, I was kind of a sissy," he would say, using the hated word. He ran from fights, he admitted. Yet his brother Vivian had no memory of Harry being teased about his glasses. And to judge by the recollections of several boyhood friends, he wasn't considered a sissy exactly, only different. Serious, as one recalled. They wanted to call him a sissy, but they just didn't do it because they had a lot of respect for him. I remember one time we were playing Jesse James or Robbers, and we were the Dalton brothers out in Kansas, and we were arguing about them. We got the history mixed up. But Harry came in and straightened it out, just who were the Dalton brothers and how many got killed, things like that the boys had a lot of respect for. They didn't call him sissy. With girls of his own age, he was so shy he could barely speak. His initial brush with other children in Independence was at Sunday school when the family first moved to town. Matt had sent him to the big new red-brick First Presbyterian Church on Lexington Street, rather than to one of the Baptist churches, because the Presbyterian minister had been especially welcoming to her. At the Presbyterian Sunday School, Harry met a blonde-haired, blue-eyed little girl named Elizabeth Wallace, and decided she was the most entrancing creature he had ever seen. But it was 5 years before he dared say a word to her. The only girls with whom he felt at ease were his cousins Ethel and Nellie Noland, the daughters of his father's sister Ella and her husband, Joseph Noland. His days passed largely in the company of women, Mama, Caroline Simpson, his teachers, or Grandma Young, who came often to visit. He was surrounded by womenfolk, and he got along with them splendidly, kidding and telling stories. His mother liked to say he was intended for a girl anyway, an observation he seems to have taken always in good spirit. Section 2. John Truman was getting on in the world. There was money now for servants, books, for studio photographs. As a surprise for the children, he bought a pair of matched red goats with custom-made harness and a miniature farm wagon. The little rig became the talk of the neighborhood. John was an early riser, an all-day striver, and thought to be pretty ingenious besides, because of his backyard gas well and various inventive ideas. He patented a staple puller for use on barbed wire fences. For an automatic railroad switch that he devised, The Missouri Pacific reportedly offered an annual royalty of $2,000. When the Chicago and Alton topped that with an offer of $2,500, four times what most American families had to live on in a year, John asked for double the amount, with the result that both railroads turned him down and adopted another version of the same thing, pirated his idea, apparently, and he wound up with nothing. It was a story told, usually, to show just how stubborn John Truman could be. As a livestock trader, he stood well in the community. He had a good eye. He could determine the age of mules or horses at a glance, seldom needing to examine their teeth, and though a quiet man, he had perfected a nice line of trade talk. More important, John Truman's word was good. "A mighty good trader, John Truman," recalled a neighbor. "Very stubborn, but on the square." Because of Harry's obvious affection for his mother, his eagerness to please her, and the enjoyment he took from her company as time went on, much would be said later of her influence, the extent to which he was his mother's son. But as time would also tell, he and his father had much in common, more, indeed, than either of them realized through much of Harry's boyhood. And the influence of the father on the son would never be discounted by those who knew John Truman, or by anyone in the family, including Harry himself. Small and compact, like a jockey, John had a weathered, sunburned face and crow's feet that gave a hint of a smile around the eyes. The grin, when it came, was the kind people warmed to and remembered, as they remembered the temper. Touchy about his size, his honor, he would explode at the least affront, "fight like a buzzsaw," as Harry would say. Once at the courthouse, when a lawyer accused him of lying, John took after the man with his fists, chasing him out the door and into the street. On election day, John Truman was nearly always in a fight. One boyhood friend of Harry's, Mize Peters, who was also the son of a horse trader, remembered a man coming into his father's place, his head covered with blood, saying he had had an argument with John Truman, who hit him with a whip. To the town, such ferocity seemed a remarkable thing in someone so unprepossessing physically and so good-natured ordinarily. A fiery fellow, it would be said, but a man of John Truman's integrity and industry, you excuse a whole lot of things. Like many men of the time, John had a strong, sentimental veneration of women. "No one could make remarks about my aunts or my mother in my father's presence without getting into serious trouble," Harry recalled. Of the three children, Mary Jane was John's favorite. Papa, it seems, was as partial to Mary Jane as Mama was to Harry. That Harry spent so much time watching over Mary Jane was in part because he knew how much it would please Papa. Unlike his own father, John was considered a liberal in religion. He professed great faith in God, but faith also in what could be accomplished through courage and determination. He had no use for a coward, according to a niece named Grace Summer. He raised his children to have faith in themselves and their potentialities. Assisted by the black hired man, Letch Simpson, John did a little farming still on rented land south of town, and occasionally he dabbled in real estate. Possibly, too, by this time he had begun speculating in grain futures in Kansas City. He was looking always for the main chance, wanting desperately to get rich. Meanwhile, as Harry said, he would trade nearly anything he owned. In 1895, when the boy was 11, John traded their house for another several blocks to the north, receiving some $5,400 in the bargain. Though the new house had less property than the one on Chrysler Avenue, it stood on a corner lot at Waldo Street and River Boulevard, a more fashionable neighborhood, and within easy walking distance of the courthouse square. Chrysler Avenue had never been the wrong side of the tracks, but for an ambitious man, 909 Waldo was unquestionably progress in the right direction. A down payment was made on a new piano for Matt, who would be remembered playing for her own amusement and amazement. When Harry showed signs of interest, she first tried teaching him herself, then arranged for regular lessons with a young woman next door, Florence Burris. A piano in the parlor had become part of the good life in America, a sign of prosperity and wholesome home entertainment, and the Trumans had an upright Kimball, the most popular piano of the day, priced at around $200. "Music for the multitudes," was the Kimball Company's slogan. Customarily, piano lessons were for the young women of a household, but Harry took to it wholeheartedly, pleased by his progress and by the approval of both parents. For Harry, no less than for his father, life was picking up. The new neighborhood was filled with children of his own age. He was making friends as never before. The Waldo Street years would be remembered like those on the farm as nothing but wonderful times. He had a gang now. Our house became headquarters for all the boys and girls around. There was a wonderful barn with stalls for horses and cows, a corn crib and a hayloft in which all the kids met and cooked up plans for all sorts of adventures. Mama remained very patient, whatever went on. As he started high school, the friendships meant even more. Paul Bryant lived on the other side of Waldo at Little Woodland College for Women, where his father was president. Across the back alley was Fielding Houchins, the Baptist minister's son. Elmer Twyman was the son of the Truman family doctor who had seen Harry through the siege of diphtheria and restored the severed tip of his toe. There was Tasker Taylor, who could draw better than anyone, and tall, shy Charlie Ross, who never missed a day of school and who, like Harry, read everything in sight. Yet, as much as he liked them all, Harry had no best pal among the boys. His only close friends remained his girl cousins, Ethel and Nellie Noland, who were as good-natured and well-read as he, interested in everything, not at all vain or pretty, and, importantly, devoted to him. Harry once calculated that he had a grand total of 39 cousins, but Ethel and Nellie were the favorites, and they would remain so all of his life. Ethel, in particular, would understand him as almost no one else ever did. Just 6 months older than Harry, Ethel was a year ahead in school. Nellie, who was 4 years older, was very like a big sister to him. As a threesome, they spent hours together after school and in the evenings, usually at the Noland house on Maple Avenue. In summer, the girls were regular visitors at the farm on Blue Ridge. Harry was always considerate, always companionable, Ethel remembered. Harry was always fun. They read Shakespeare aloud, taking parts. After doing Hamlet, Ethel began calling him Horatio, brave Horatio, the staunch friend. The Noland sisters knew, too, how much he still secretly cared for Elizabeth Wallace, who had been in his class from the time he switched to the Columbian School in fourth grade, and who, year after year, because of the alphabetical seating arrangement, occupied the desk immediately behind him. Bessie, as everyone called her, lived on North Delaware Street, 2.5 blocks from the Trumans, in a tall frame house, number 608, with a bur oak shading the front lawn. "If I succeeded in carrying her books to school and back home for her, I had a big day," he would later say, appraising how far he had advanced in overcoming his shyness. She was his ideal. She was popular. She stood out in class, always dressed in the latest thing, A natural, all-round athlete, she played baseball as well as a boy. As third baseman, she had no trouble with the long throw to first. She could run faster than her brothers and beat them in tennis. She was better at tennis than almost anyone her age, as Harry knew from watching her on the courts at Woodland College. In winter, he would stand and watch her race off on skates across the college pond. She could skate, she could dance, she could do so much that he could not, that he had never learned. She could even whistle through her teeth, as almost no girl ever could. Her street, North Delaware, with its ample houses and sidewalks of hexagonal flagstone, was considered the finest street in Independence, the houses lending an air of dignity to the whole neighborhood west of the square. The tall gray residence of her wealthy grandfather, George Porterfield Gates, up the street on North Delaware, was one of the show places of town. Grandmother Gates was English. At Christmas, Bessie gave gifts to her friends wrapped in fancy paper and wore silk dresses to formal parties and dances of the kind to which Harry was never invited. Besides, Bessie was a Presbyterian, which socially put her at the top of the pole. Since the war, the Baptists had slipped to perhaps third or fourth place below the Campbellites and the Northern Methodists and Southern Methodists, but were still ahead of the Lutherans, the Catholics, and the reorganized Latter-day Saints, those Mormons who had come back from Utah. Asked long afterward whether she remembered Harry Truman hanging about the Wallace house in the years they were all growing up, Bessie's close friend and next-door neighbor, Mary Paxton, responded emphatically, "No, no, Harry was a Baptist." Section 3. It was, as people said, the kind of town where everybody knew everybody and everybody's business. The population was 6,000 and growing, but only slowly. Compared to Kansas City, it was a sleepy backwater. Church-going, conservative, rooted to the past, exactly as most residents preferred. Kansas City was a brassy Yankee town, money-wise and full of new people. Independence was Southern in both spirit and pace, really more Southern than Midwestern, and very set in its ways. There had been considerable building since the war. The coming of the railroads, the pell-mell growth of Kansas City, the rise of several new local enterprises had had an effect. North Delaware Street, which ran north-south, four blocks west of the square, was a perfect example of the changed look. The large Boleen House, the Sawyer House with its Tiffany glass windows, the big Gates place, were all new since the war, like the money that built them. The Boleens belonged to the family that founded Kansas City's most popular dry goods firm, Emery Byrd Thayer. Aaron Sawyer was head of the Bank of Independence, which had been organized since the war. George Porterfield Gates was partner in the Wagner Gates Milling Company of Independence, founded in 1866, which hit a bonanza with Queen of the Pantry Flour, a product known throughout the Midwest. Gates himself was part of a post-war Yankee influx. He had come from Vermont by way of Illinois, joined William Wagner in the milling business in 1883, and 2 years later greatly remodeled and expanded his relatively modest house at the corner of North Delaware and Blue Avenue, spending in all, according to the Independent Sentinel, a fabulous $8,000. Painted gray, with black trim at the windows, the finished clapboard mansion had 14 rooms, verandas front and rear, fancy fretwork, tinted flashed glass in the front bay windows, slate roof, gas illumination, and hot and cold running water. Gates's partner, William Wagner, lived in even grander style, across from the mill on Pacific Street, in the house George Caleb Bingham once occupied, but that Wagner had done over, sparing no expense. It sat on a knoll in a leafy, park-like setting of 20 acres. The Swope place on South Pleasant Street had a ballroom on the top floor. The Swope fortune came from land in Kansas City. The Vale House on North Liberty, the showiest house in Independence, was a towering, stone-trimmed, red-brick Victorian wedding cake with 31 rooms and Carrara marble fireplaces. The Vale stable had mahogany-paneled stalls. There was a greenhouse and 4 full-time gardeners. If Harvey Vale, who made his money in pure water and contract mail delivery, was not the richest man in town, he certainly lived as though he were. Overall, it was quite a handsome community. The primary streets were paved, clean, and shaded by large old elms and cottonwoods. People took pride in their gardens. On summer evenings after dark, families sat visiting on front porches, their voices part of the night for anybody crossing the lawns between houses. National holidays and politics provided what little excitement occurred from one year to another. Most memorable for young Harry Truman was the day of Grover Cleveland's second victory in 1892, when the family was still in the house on Chrysler Avenue. John Truman had scrambled to the top of the roof to tie a flag to the gilded weather vane, and that night, looking extremely proud, he rode a gray horse in a torchlight parade. Bessie Wallace's friend, Mary Paxton, a latter-day chronicler of town life, remembered how the men with their blazing torches came swinging down North Delaware, leaving a trail of light under the dark trees. She, Harry, all their generation would remember it as a night of nights, since 20 years went by before Democrats, with the election of Wilson, could celebrate another presidential victory. In lots of ways, it was a country town still. Roosters crowed at dawn. Dinner remained a midday meal in many households. The standard Sunday dinner after church was fried chicken, buttered peas, mashed potatoes, cream gravy, and beaten biscuits, which, being made of queen-of-the-pantry flour, a soft wheat flour, were understood to be the world's best. Mud-spattered buggies and farm wagons clogged the square on Saturday nights, when the farmers came to town for haircuts and supplies. Town boys grew up with farmers' chores as part of the daily routine. Harry and Vivian had cows to milk, horses to curry, water and feed, wood to split for the kitchen stove. On clear winter nights, with the trees bare and the soft glow of gas and oil lamps still the only light in the windows of town, stars in the black sky overhead blazed with a clarity that residents of a later electrified era would never experience. Local boosters insisted on calling it a city and bragged about the new electric plant under construction at a cost of $30,000 or the new high school, which had cost still more. Local merchants were described as unexcelled in regard to integrity, uprightness, and faithfulness in business affairs, and cordiality and good nature in social life. Yet, for all this, there was an air of great understated gentility, even sophistication. There were those in town among the old moneyed families who talked of travels in Europe, or summers in Colorado Springs. Study groups met to discuss literature and poetry, and with a degree of appreciation and vitality that could take visitors by surprise. The teaching in the schools Harry attended was superb. In addition to Woodland College for women, there was Presbyterian College, also for women, and St. Mary's Academy for girls. These, to be sure, were only tiny, struggling institutions. The usual graduating class at Woodland numbered just a dozen or so. But they were well regarded and cause for much local pride. Independence, remembered Ethel Noland years later, stood for culture, a claim easy for outsiders to scoff at, she knew, but that she and others like her took very much to heart. "There was conversation," she said. "I mean by that, talk about what was going on in the world, talk about ideas." The town supported two bookstores, and most of the leading families took the Kansas City papers, in addition to the Sentinel or the Jackson Examiner. Kansas City, furthermore, was only a 10-mile ride by trolley or on the new train known as the Airline. So there was little sense of being cut off from the wide world, if the wide world was what you wished. And with so much history attached to the town, no one with a feeling for the past could find it uninteresting. No town in the West is richer in historical interest than the beautiful city of Independence, declared a new guide to Independence. At the point south of town where the wagon trains had crossed Blue River, crevices worn by their wheels were still plainly evident. George Caleb Bingham had painted his Order No. 11 in one of the old outbuildings at the Wagoner Estate. The brick walls of the Chrisman Sawyer Bank on the northwest corner of the Courthouse Square showed the scars still of Civil War battles. And on pleasant mornings in the years of Harry Truman's childhood, old Marshal Peacock could often be seen walking stiffly about town, a spare, erect figure with a white beard and cane, who, as everyone knew, still carried the bullet fired by Jim Crow Chiles lodged in his spine. George Porterfield Gates, Bessie Wallace's grandfather, liked to frighten and delight Bessie and her friends with his tale of a late-night drive home in a buggy from a long-ago country wedding. A mysterious rider had appeared out of the dark, put a gun to Gates's neck, and held it there all the way into town. It was Jim Crow Chiles, who, Gates was sure, had only murder in his heart. But as they turned down North Delaware Street, Jim Crow laughed his fiendish laugh and vanished in the night as suddenly as he had appeared. The atmosphere remained pervadingly Southern. Antebellum Old South, unreconstructed. Handkerchiefs were waved whenever the band played Dixie. The United Daughters of the Confederacy thrived, and such formal parties as attended by genteel young folk like Bessie Wallace and her friends were hardly different from those put on in Macon or Tuscaloosa, from the floral decorations and twining stair rails to the refreshments of chicken salad and Charlotte Russe. The biggest memorial in Woodland Cemetery was the Confederate Monument. Portraits of Lee and Jackson were displayed prominently in many front parlors, and in summer, Quantrill's boys, grizzled, tobacco-chewing border war veterans dressed as if for church, gathered for day-long outdoor reunions, a portrait of Quantrill draped in crepe as their centerpiece. Often, Jesse James's brother Frank appeared for such occasions, causing great excitement. At school, one of Harry's favorite teachers, Ardelia Hardin, who taught Latin, would describe for the class how her father had been hit 3 times during Pickett's charge at Gettysburg and left for dead until discovered by Catholic sisters and taken to a Baltimore hospital, where, once recovered, he refused to swear allegiance to the United States and for this was imprisoned for the remainder of the war. Harry always wanted to know about that, Miss Hardin would remember half a century later, very pleased. Virtually the entire town was American-born. Though nearly every black resident past the age of 40 had been born in slavery. Immigrant Irish, Italians, Croatians, and other foreign impoverished people of the kind crowding into the vile west bottoms of Kansas City were rarely ever seen in Independence. Black residents lived in what was called Nigger Neck, a cluster of makeshift houses and shacks in a persimmon grove northwest of the square. Blacks were unwelcome at most stores and were denied use of the town library. Black children went to a separate school, the Young School, named for the free black wagon maker of pioneer days, Hiram Young. And while white families like the Trumans might feel great lifelong affection for their own black servants, words like nigger and coon were used as a matter of course in so-called polite society. And below the surface always lay a threat of violence, should any blacks forget their place. News of lynchings in the South were given lurid play by both local papers, invariably in the spirit that the victim only got what he had coming to him. The summer of 1901, the year Harry finished high school, the Jackson Examiner declared on its editorial page, "The community at large need not be especially surprised if there is a Negro lynching in Independence. The conditions are favorable at this time. There are a lot of worthless young Negro men in town who do nothing. They do not pretend to work and stand around on the streets and swear and make remarks about ladies and others who may pass by. They crowd into the electric cars and become offensive." There were also in town, the editors were careful to add, many law-abiding Negroes who are good citizens and who understand the truth of what we say as well as anyone. Certain precepts and bywords were articles of faith in such a place, in such times, and nearly everybody growing up there was imbued with them, in principle at least. Honesty was the best policy. It saved time and worry, because if you always told the truth, you never had to keep track of what you said. Make yourself useful. Anything worthwhile required effort. If at first you don't succeed, try again. Never, never give up, Harry's father would say. Children were a reflection of their parents. "Now, Harry, you be good," his mother would tell him time after time as he went out the door. He appears never to have questioned such dictates any more than he questioned the established inequality of black people. In those days, he would remember, right was right and wrong was wrong, and you didn't have to talk about it. Many of the most familiar guidelines came directly from the Bible. "Honor thy father and mother. A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches. Seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. Be of good cheer." From Sunday school and his own reading of the Bible, Harry knew many passages by heart, particularly Matthew 5, 6, and 7, the Sermon on the Mount. "Ye are the salt of the earth. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works." He memorized a prayer, one he would say through much of his life. "O Almighty and everlasting God, Creator of heaven, earth, and the universe, help me to be, to think, to act what is right because it is right. Make me truthful, honest, and honorable in all things. Make me intellectually honest for the sake of right and honor, and without thought of reward to me. Give me the ability to be charitable, forgiving, and patient with my fellow men. Help me to understand their motives and their shortcomings, even as thou understandest mine. Amen, amen, amen." Say what you mean. Mean what you say, he was taught at home. Keep your word. Never get too big for your britches. Never forget a friend. They were more than words to the wise. They were bedrock, as clearly established, as integral to the way of life, it seemed, as were the very landmarks of the community. Its schools, church steeples, and courthouse. Not everyone lived up to them, of course, but to Harry it seemed Everyone ought to try. The square was the center of the world if the town was the limit of your experience, and at age 14, while still in high school, Harry went to work on the square at J.H. Clinton's drugstore. It was his first paying job. Clinton's drugstore stood at the northeast corner of the square. Proprietor Clinton lived upstairs. Harry's job was to come in each weekday morning at 6:30 to open up the place, sweep the sidewalk, mop the floor, wipe the counters, and do as much overall dusting and cleaning as possible before 7 o'clock when Mr. Clinton came down and it was time for Harry to leave for school. More than half a century later, he could remember it all in detail. There must have been 1,000 bottles to dust and yards of patent medicine cases and shelves to clean. At least it seemed that way, because I never finished the bottles and shelves by school time and had to start the next morning where I'd left off the day before. By the time I got around to them all, it was time to start over. Two large glass vases in the front windows had to be cleaned and dusted, as well as a surrounding display of patent medicines. The windows were to be washed once a week, the prescription cases dusted very, very carefully. Saturdays and Sundays, the boy worked from 4 in the afternoon until 10 at night by the courthouse clock, when Mr. Clinton would lock up and Harry would head off in the dark, the lights in other shop windows along the square going out one by one. Hurrying, he could make it home in 12 minutes. J.H. Clinton advertised cigars, smokers' supplies and tobaccos, perfumes, toilet articles, soaps and stationery, prescriptions carefully compounded day or night. But the store accommodated the town in yet another way, as Harry soon discovered. And it was this, apparently, that awakened him for the first time to the hypocrisies of certain prominent citizens known for their moral rectitude, the high hats, as he called them. In a little closet under the prescription case, which faced the front and shut off the view of the back end of the store, was an assortment of whiskey bottles. Early in the morning, sometimes before Mr. Clinton arrived, the good church members and anti-saloon leaguers would come in for their early morning drink behind the prescription case at 10 cents an ounce. They would wipe their mouths, peep through the observation hole in front of the case, and depart. This procedure gave a 14-year-old boy quite a viewpoint on the public front of leading citizens and Amen Corner praying churchmen. He would set the bottle on the counter and wait. They'd put their dimes on the counter, and I'd leave all those dimes there until Mr. Clinton came in and he'd put them in the cash register. It was because these customers were such counterfeits that he hated having any part in the transaction. Far better, he thought, were the tough old birds around town who bought a proper drink in a real saloon whenever they wished, regardless of appearances. The drugstore was one of several shops and stores fashioned out of what had once been the old Noland House, the Frontier Hotel and Saloon, where the body of Harry's infamous uncle, Jim Crow Childs, had been laid out after the shooting, a point of history Harry surely knew all about, but never spoke of. The store was at the corner of Maple and Main, which, with Lexington and Liberty, framed the square. A jewelry store, a bookshop, two groceries, the Hotel Metropolitan, H.W. Rummel's harness and saddle shop, a dry goods store, and the Courthouse Exchange Saloon were in the same block on Maple. Elsewhere around the square, all facing the courthouse, were three more drug stores, two more saloons, A.J. Bunshoe's department store, once a patron, always a patron, two barber shops, a tobacco shop, a shoe store, a theater, an opera house, a hardware store, a bakery, and an ice cream parlor. Three banks, the First National, the Bank of Independence, and the old brick Chrisman Sawyer, stood prominently at three different corners, while upstairs over several of the stores were various law and dental offices and Miss Dunlap's dancing classes. A lumber yard, the Western Union offices, a barbershop for blacks, 2 livery stables, a feed store, the post office, the town jail, and the airline railroad station were just off the square, which meant that most of life's necessities were all extremely handy, including the Ott Mitchell Undertaking Parlor, which stood catty-cornered to J.H. Clinton's drugstore. But for size and impressiveness, nothing approached the courthouse, rising from its shaded lawn at the center of the square. The simple, dignified little building of old, with its fanlight over the door, had long since disappeared, swallowed up by a great red brick renovation in the high Victorian mode, with a mansard-roofed clock tower 5 stories tall. The courthouse was the focal point of Independence. The clock tower could be seen for miles jutting above the trees. And the courthouse, of course, was democratic. For though Republicans were not unknown in Independence, the town remained solidly democratic. People were born and raised Democrats as they were born and raised Baptists or Catholics. It wasn't something you questioned. As one said, "You were a Democrat come hell or high water." Or you were a Republican. In the warm months, on wooden benches in the dappled light of the courthouse lawn, the town loafers and philosophers congregated. Courthouse politicians, tradesmen, out-of-town salesmen, store clerks and bank presidents, mothers in long skirts shopping with their daughters, a good part of the town passed up and down the sidewalks, stopping frequently to visit. The dark green Kansas City streetcar arrived and departed, making its cautious turn at Liberty and Lexington with bell clanging and a screech of wheels. In full summer, farm wagons laden with fresh produce lined the curbstones. Some summers, to keep the dust down, the town water wagon had to circle the square several times daily. To go up to the square each morning to a regular job was for a boy to be very like a man. It was to be known, to be spoken to, and spoken well of if one were a brisk, cheerful, dependable boy like Harry Truman. And however disillusioned he may have been by some of the clientele at the drugstore, he was clearly enjoying himself, and probably would have stayed on, had his father not intervened. His first week's wages of 3 silver dollars were, in memory, "the biggest thing that ever happened to me." He bought a present for his mother and tried to give what money was left to his father, who said kindly that he should keep it for himself. After 3 months, John Truman told the boy he had done enough. Better that he concentrate on his studies. Section 4. He grew dutifully,